So think about your life. Here's the reality. If you're a parent, you have at least one story of an epic failure. If you're a kid, you could probably tell of one story where your parents failed in an epic way. And Pam and I are no different. We were fortunate enough to have four kids, fairly healthy. A couple of them had to have tubes when they were younger, but really, you know, nothing serious after that. Dentists always were pretty good, maybe a couple fillings here or there. Eyesight, we took them in when they were like two, got their eyes checked, everything was good. And so, you know, when you have four kids, and especially if the older two are doing really well, you sometimes forget about the younger two. And so we're going along in life, and a few years after the eye check, we thought, you know what, we should really get the kids' eyes checked again. And then the next year we'd roll around, and we really should get the kids' eyes checked. They seem to be doing okay. So last year, we finally got around to checking some eyes. And the first three went through no problem. And we got to our youngest, Kieran. And after the optometrist was done checking her eyes, he said, yeah, she's going to need glasses. I was going, what? What do you mean she needs glasses? He goes, yeah, she needs glasses. And you see, over the previous years, Kieran had mentioned once or twice, maybe I should get glasses. And I just need to give you a little family history here. Pam, when she was younger, didn't need glasses, but wanted glasses, so she told her parents she needed glasses. So they actually went out and bought her glasses. So she's just thinking, she's just pulling a mini Pam thing here. She doesn't need glasses. So anyways, the glasses got made, and as Pam was getting ready to leave, the person said, now you just watch your daughter. They walk outside, get to the car, they get in the car, and Kieran goes to my wife, wow, Mom, I didn't know you could actually see the leaves on the trees. I just thought it was a blur, and everyone saw the blur of the tree. Epic parenting failure right there. Your 12-year-old daughter has been blind for 10 years. It doesn't surprise me that later on that year she comes home, she goes, Dad, you know what? I kind of like baseball. I went, really? You never played before. But I guess if you can't see the ball, you're not really going to enjoy the sport. I'm sure if we gave you enough time, each one of you could stand up and share epic failures stories as parents, like leaving a child in a car seat on the front steps and driving away. Or leaving kids in a park and walking home, or whatever it may be. We all have our stories, don't we? No family is immune to epic failures. So I want you to look around right now. Look around at some others around here. And I want you to judge them. I want you to look at someone and you go, you know what? They look like they have it all together. I wish I was like them. Okay, just look around. You got to have someone in your mind because we're going to get back to it. So just make sure you know who you're looking at and who you're thinking about this. And as you're thinking that, I want to leave you with this statement. Remember, no family is immune from problems. So the person you just looked at, the family you just considered, they have problems too. You might think your life is a mess. You might think, man, I wish my family was like them. But they have problems too. Every family has problems. And you should have comfort in that, knowing that we all have this commonality. Every single one of us grows up in a family, and we all have our problems. We're in this together. Maybe this week at your community group, you could start off by just sharing some epic family parenting failures. That'll just get you going. I'm sure you won't even have to talk about anything else this week. You could just keep going for hours on that. Hopefully none of your family failures are epic enough that you get nominated for the Jerry Springer Show, or there's a network coming and knocking on your door and saying, we'd really like to do a reality TV series of your family. Hopefully that's not you. You should also find some comfort in knowing that the Bible is full of dysfunctional families. So no matter how messed up your family upbringing has been or is, I bet you I could find worse family upbringings in the Bible. There's always someone that's worse off than you. And so this week, we're starting a new series that will carry for the next 5 weeks after this. We're studying the life of Joseph. And this isn't the Joseph of the New Testament, even though it probably would make a great tie into Christmas. But my wife thought we were, as of last Sunday when I said, hey, we're starting a new series. She thought I was talking about Joseph of the New Testament. No, we're going old school. Going the Old Testament. So if you have your Bibles, we want to start today. We're going to look at Genesis chapter 37. And I just want to start by reading the first two verses, and then we'll get into the rest of it. Listen to this. Genesis 37, starting at verse 1. Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob. If you know the rest of the story, you know that this really isn't the story of Jacob. It's actually the story of Joseph. Even though Jacob makes his appearances now and again, but from now, verses chapter 37 all the way to chapter 50, it's really the story of Joseph and how God works in Joseph's life through Joseph to fulfill a promise that he made to Abraham, and we'll get into that in the coming weeks. And when I first read this, I kind of looked at that and I thought, well, that's kind of odd. Why would the author say this is the account of Jacob when really we're talking about Joseph? And as I thought about it this week, one thing struck me. I think the author is trying to make the point that often, as parents, we are defined by our children. Think about that for a second. In a culture where we live, where we define ourselves by our accomplishments, how much we have, what kind of job we do, that kind of stuff, to sit back and take a look at this verse and then ponder that actually maybe our kids are actually a reflection of who we are. As one person I spoke to said, maybe they expose who we are is better than defining who we are. But there seems to be a reality that we cannot understand Jacob without understanding his children. And to get a picture into Jacob's life, we can take a picture of his kid's life and actually get a good read on what's going on in Jacob's life. So maybe the question to start with for you today is, if you're not, don't have kids, not married, are you a good reflection of your parents? Do you really reflect who your parents are? Or as those of you who have kids, do your kids reflect who you really want them to reflect? You know, you. Or do you look at them and go, ooh, boy, I'm in trouble now. We are in some ways defined by our children, aren't we? So have that in your mind as I read the rest of the chapter. We don't have it on the screen. If you have your Bibles, follow along. Or just close your eyes and listen to the story of Joseph. Continuing in verse 2, Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the son of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in old age, and he made him a richly ornamented robe for him. Some versions have a multicolored robe or a many-colored robe. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him, and they could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were building sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brother said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream and he told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." He has 11 brothers, just to put it in context. Then when he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Now his brothers had gone to graze their father's flock near Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, "As you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I am going to send you to them." "Very well," he replied. So he said to them, go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flock and bring word back to me. Then he sent him off from the valley of Hebron. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, a man found him wandering around in the fields and asked him, what are you looking for? He replied, I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they are grazing their flocks? They moved on from here, the man said. I heard them say, let's go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. Here comes that dreamer, they said to each other. Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams. When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. Let's not take his life, he said. Don't shed any blood. Throw him into the cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him. Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. Just to put that into context, Reuben is the oldest of all the brothers. And we don't know the motive of why he is trying to save Joseph. We just know that he's trying to save him. One of the things you need to understand about how dysfunctional this family really is that Jacob had four wives. Anytime you have more than one, you're setting yourself up for dysfunction. I'm just going to give you that as free advice this morning, okay? And if you really want to get dysfunctional, make sure that two of those wives are actually sisters. And so you have these four wives, two of them sisters. Reuben is the oldest. And get this. One day when Reuben had nothing better to do, he decided to slip into the tent and sleep with one of his stepmoms. So you have that as some dysfunction going on. How's your family rating next to Jacob's family, by the way, now? And so I wonder sometimes if Reuben didn't have this idea, he's on the outs with his dad. That tends to happen when you sleep with one of his wives. And I wonder if he sees this as an opportunity to save Joseph, to get back into the good graces, because Joseph is the favorite son, right? So I just leave you with that. Text doesn't tell us that, but I wonder. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the richly ornamented robe he was wearing, and then they took him and threw him into the cistern. Now the cistern was empty. There was no water in it. I think the author tells us that because then we know he's not going to drown. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, Judah's the schemer, right? What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother. Our own flesh and blood, his brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him down to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern, obviously he had gone away to do something, and saw that Joseph wasn't there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, the boy isn't there, where can I turn now? Which gives us an indication that he may well have wanted to write something with his father. When he got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, dipped the robe in the blood. They took the ornamented robe back to their father and said, we found this, examine this to see whether it is your son's robe. Notice they don't even use the word Joseph. They dislike him so much that they can't even bring themselves to call him by his name. He recognized it and said, it is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. No, he said, in mourning I will go down to the grave to my son. So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. There's a piece where Judah says, hey, we can make some money off this, right? And so he says, look, there's some traveling merchants. If you caught the name of the merchants, there seem to be two groups of people in this group, the Ishmaelites and the Midianites. If you know of any of the Israelites' history, you'll know that these were actually the cousins of the brothers. The Ishmaelites come from Hagar and Abraham, who Abraham is Joseph's grandfather. Great-grandfather? Great-grandfather? The Midianites come from a woman that Abraham married as well. And so all these people are related. And so these brothers decide, well, you know what? We're not going to kill him because really, do we want to face the same wrath that Cain faced with Abel? They were brothers. They're not supposed to kill each other. Let's just sell them into slavery, shall we? That seems like a better alternative. We get rid of them, and yet we don't kill them. And so you have this family mess going on. And it all starts with Jacob. Jacob's name literally means the deceiver. I don't know if you knew that. But can you imagine naming your kid, as he comes out of the womb, the deceiver? What kind of path are you setting your child on? And Jacob, true to his name, lives up to that. If you study his life, you'll realize that numerous times he lies to get what he wants. Whether it's his wife, whether it's to gain flocks, whether whatever it is, whether to get a birthright from his twin brother. He lies over and over and over again. God comes along and says, you know what? I'm going to change your name from Jacob, the deceiver, to Israel, which means he struggles with God. I'm not sure that's a better name, but God seemed to know what he was doing, because the patriarch Israel, or Jacob, now is named he struggles for God. And if you know anything of the Jewish history, you read the Old Testament, boy, did his descendants live up to that name, didn't they? So you have Jacob the deceiver, who is now a parent. And even though we know every family has its problems, if passive parenting becomes your style of parenting, it will set your family up for failure. Because I think this story of Jacob is an example of what happens when parents are passive. And if you've grown up in a home where your parents were passive, you know some of the heartache of what happens. And the warning, I think, for some of you today who are maybe raising young kids or teenagers, if you are a passive parent, there are some things you need to look out for. Because I don't think it's going to end well for you. So a number of things happen when you have passive parenting. The first thing that happens is that if you have more than one child, you often look at your children, and the one you like the most is the one that is the easiest to handle. As a passive parent, you do not want to, you know, discipline. You don't want to get them in trouble. You're just hoping that your children, you wound them up when they were born, and they can operate on their own. And as long as they don't mess it up too much, they become your favorite. Because you don't have to deal with them. And so when favoritism comes part of the passive parenting, there are a whole lot of dynamics that happen in a family when there is a favored child. And notice what happens in Joseph's family. In verse 3, it tells us that Jacob loved Joseph. And it goes on to say that he was born in Jacob's old age. What that verse doesn't tell us, and what we learn from previous readings earlier in Genesis, is that of the four wives that Jacob had a favorite, and it was Rachel. He loved her above all the others. And it shouldn't surprise us that Joseph is the son of the favored wife. And as you read the story, you realize that there's a lot of dynamics going on. Leah, Rachel's sister, and her are married, and they have this competition about producing sons for Jacob, and Rachel's actually barren, and Leah produces a ton of sons, and then finally God opens Rachel's womb, and Rachel has a child, and it's Joseph. And it tells us that Jacob was old when that happens. So think about this. Jacob has a favored wife, loves her the most, trying to have kids with her. It's not happening, it's not happening, it's not happening, and then one day she gets pregnant and has this long-awaited son. And he becomes his favorite. And so how does Jacob show this? He shows it by giving Joseph this coat. And whether it's multicolored or whether it's ornamented, it was a fancy coat. And the actual literal wording of what is there is would mean to be a long sleeve coat or a long coat that would go to the ground. And so normally in everyday life, someone in Joseph's day would have a short tunic. So it would be short, so, you know, usually above the knee or just below the knee, and either short sleeves or no sleeves. And the reason for that is You had to go out in the field and work, whether it was taking care of the sheep, the animals, or planting. You could not work when you had a full-length coat on. Have you ever tried working with a full-length coat on, long sleeves? It's pretty hard. And so this full-length coat, long sleeves, was a sign of someone who was wealthy, usually a noble. So picture this. Jacob loves Joseph. Everyone knows that he loves Joseph. He's the son of the favored wife, the most loved wife. And what does he do? He gives Joseph this coat, this amazing coat. And I know that might be hard for us to contend because I bet you even this morning as you were walking into the house, you had a choice to make. You had to choose which coat you were going to wear, and you maybe had to choose not whether it was going to keep you dry, but whether it matched your outfit or not. Joseph only has one coat, I'm pretty sure. The other guys may not even have a coat. And so you have the favored son, and Jacob gives Joseph this coat. And can you imagine what the brothers would think? Look, he's dressed as a noble. Dad just gave him a coat that implies that he's not expecting Joseph to work. Remember the age difference. Joseph's 17. Some of these guys, Reuben might have been like 45. Can you imagine that? The oldest son, who's been working his butt off, taking care of the sheep, the goats, at 45, comes home one day, and his 17-year-old young punk brother has this amazing coat. What do I get, Dad? In essence, in many ways, I think what Jacob is doing is basically telling the rest of the brothers who he thinks is going to be the head of the family when he dies. I'm going to give Joseph, my favored son, this nice coat, and it's a symbol, I think, that the other brothers go, okay, we know what's going on here now. We know who Jacob wants to have leading this family after he dies. What gives him the right? He's like the second youngest, right? There's one more son named Benjamin who's younger than Joseph, but you have to remember the story. When Benjamin is born, Rachel dies in childbirth. I don't think Benjamin was Jacob's favorite son after that. So Joseph is it. He is the guy. But I don't want to dump on Jacob too much because Jacob actually learns this from his own parents. If you know the story of Jacob and Esau, you know that they came out, they were twins, they were born. And when they came out and after they started living this life, the Bible tells us that Isaac, Jacob's dad, loved Esau. And it tells us in Scripture that his mom loved him. And so already in the home that Jacob grew up in, there is dysfunction. Father loves one son, mother loves the other son, and they pit each other against each other. And as you read the story, mom schemes behind father's back to get Jacob the birthright, to get Jacob to be the one to carry on the family name. So Jacob comes to this scheming, this favoritism. Honestly, that's all he's known as he's been growing up. That's how he knows to run a family. You favor one of the sons, and then you live life. That's how you do it. Favoritism. Have you ever, you know, as you examine your own family, when you're a single, you know, when you're an only child, favoritism usually isn't a problem. But once you throw at least one other in the mix, it can become a problem. Especially for parents, because sometimes as a parent, you relate to another child better or easier, and it becomes really easy to start favoring that child. Sometimes it's because you have shared or mutual interests that you like, sports or what, you know, whatever women do together. And you can, without even knowing it, start favoring a child. And you can start creating this complex web in your family. And all of a sudden, dysfunction springs up. But not only is favoritism an aspect of passive parenting, there's the issue of discipline. Passive parenting leads to little or no discipline in a family. You have this section on the dreams. Starts in verse 11. In the first dream, Joseph is telling his brothers a dream. Like, how many times have you ever done that? I don't personally remember a lot of my dreams, but every once in a while I do. And so, you know, hey, Pam, I had this dream last night. You know, it's almost innocent. And yet the dream that he remembers is a very significant dream because it's a God-given dream. But he tells his brothers, how do you think they respond after seeing Joseph given this coat that implies his dad doesn't really care if he works, but is grooming him for the head of the family, when he comes on and says, hey, I had this dream where my sheaf stood up and all your sheaves bow down to it. Joseph is 17. Apparently he doesn't have a lot of emotional intelligence. Right? Like, I think you keep that one to yourself, Joseph. That's only going to create problems for you, buddy. And then he has a second dream. And this one has the sun and the moon and the stars bowing down to him. And he tells his brother and they get mad. And it tells him that, you know, they get jealous of him. They hate him. But then he goes and tells his dad. And this is the only part, the only place where I see where Jacob actually does some disciplining. He rebukes his son. But it's a very self-interest rebuke. Basically, he's saying, what do you mean? You expect me and your moms to bow down to you? Like, that's not how our culture works, son. Dads don't bow down to their children. Children bow down to their dads. I was okay when you were talking about you and your brothers and them bowing down to you. I didn't rebuke you then, you notice. He didn't get rebuked then. Only when it affected Jacob himself does the rebuke come out. And that's often what happens in passive parenting, is things will happen in the family, things will happen in the family, until finally the mom or the dad who's passive, it just gets to them, and then they go, oh, I got to deal with this now, and they just lash out and go, boom, you're rebuked. Right? So if you happen to be raised in a family where you are the golden child, just remember this. You might be the golden child and you can't get out of that because really it's your parents doing that to you. But remember how your other siblings feel. You do have control of how you relate to them. You do or can have wisdom to know what to say and not to say at the appropriate times to spur that relationship bad blood on or help cool it. So regardless of what your parents are doing, if you are the golden child, and that can even be in your 40s and 50s, by the way, it doesn't stop just because you leave home. If you are the golden child in your family, tread carefully with your siblings. The other aspect of it and the other side of it is, kids, if your parents discipline you, be grateful. If your parents discipline you on a regular basis, be grateful. Because that means they're not being passive in their upbringing of you. And if you're a young adult, maybe today's the day you go back to your parents and say, you know what, Mom, Dad, thanks for disciplining me. Thanks for not being passive. Thanks for being so invested in my life and how I would turn out that you took the time and made the importance to discipline me when I was younger. Maybe that's the thing that you need to do today to encourage your parents. Passive parenting usually often leads to favoritism. It will often mean that there's very little or no discipline in the home, but it also means that you don't really protect your kids. Think of the story. In verses 12 and 13, it tells us that Jacob sent Joseph to Shechem to go visit his brothers to find out what was going on. Now, for many of you, the word Shechem might not mean a whole lot, but if you understand the story of Jacob, it actually means something. Back in chapter 34, as Jacob and his family was traveling to Hebron where they were going to settle, they stop in the area of Shechem, and something horrific happens in Shechem. Jacob's daughter, Dinah, gets raped. She gets raped by a man in Shechem. And as a passive parent, Jacob does nothing. Can you imagine that? As a parent with daughters, for those of you who have daughters, your daughter gets raped and you do nothing. Nothing. And so what happens is, because Jacob does nothing, the brothers decide to do something. And they concoct a scheme, and they do this scheme, and it ends with all the men being killed in Shechem. The brothers murder all of them, slaughter them. And I wonder if Jacob's sitting there, this highlight of passivity, this black mark on his parenting ability, when he says, okay, hey, Joseph, I need you to go to Shechem, where your brothers are. Whether he had any guilt at all, realizing that his epic failure happened at Shechem. I also wonder, what the heck were the brothers doing there? Like, why would you go back to a place, one, that it reminds you of this terrible thing? Maybe it's because there was no guys living there and they knew they'd be safe. They'd killed them all. I don't know. But they go there. Passivity does not protect your children. You see, because the underlying thing with passivity is you believe, you get deceived into believing that everything might turn out okay. You know, they just have to go through this phase as kids. They just have to grow up. And I'm trusting that it's going to be okay. It's going to be all right. It's going to turn out good. But here's the problem. When you're passive as a parent, you don't end up dealing with your issues. And here's the story of Jacob not dealing with his own issues. And you see it played out in his children. You have Reuben, who's lying to his brothers. Right? Hey, let's not kill him. Let's just put him in the cistern and leave him there. When really he wants to save him and pull him out, right? You have the brothers coming back later on with this coat going, okay, let's put blood on it. Let's lie to our dad about what really happened to Joseph. Make sure all the silver we're carrying home isn't clinking in our pockets so he knows that we didn't do anything untoward to our brother. And what do? They go back and they lie to their dad saying, hey, look, we found this coat. It's got blood on it. Is it Joseph's? The deceiver Jacob lives his life deceiving. His children pick up on it. They are well-schooled in the art of deception. Is it any surprise that they end up deceiving their dad? None whatsoever. That's what passive parenting does. If you're not willing as a parent to actively look at your own life, your own upbringing, and look at the flaws that you have gained from your parents, you will undoubtedly pass them on to your children. Undoubtedly. Unless you're willing to face the hard reality of that and work on them. And yet Joseph, I think, is a little bit different. We're going to get into this later on as we continue to look at his life, but I think there's just an inkling of it here in this chapter. In verse 2, what does it say about Joseph? It says, Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, four of them. Because the two wives each had two kids. And he brought their father a bad report of him. So he's a young guy, 17. He's out working the sheep with his brothers. Something happened out there. Well, maybe it was they took a couple sheep, sold them, pocketed the money. You know, dad's never going to miss a couple sheep. If he counts when we get home, we'll just tell him we lost them. Or maybe they decided to have a big feast, so they killed one and had a great meal. The sheep isn't theirs. It tells us that actually it is their dad's sheep. And maybe they come back and say, you know what? A wild animal got one of them, so we just ended up cooking up the rest of it so the meat wouldn't get bad. We wouldn't spoil it. Whatever happened, Joseph knew it was wrong. And he went back. And normally when you read this passage, often commentators will say, you know what? Joseph was just a tattletale. No wonder his brothers hated him. I wonder whether it's actually Joseph showing the first signs of his integrity. Understanding that he had been commissioned to look after his dad's sheep, he was responsible for them. So whatever the brothers were doing was not in the best interests of their dad. And he decided to tell his dad about it. Joseph makes a choice, and we're going to see this over the next few weeks, that his integrity is way more important than the consequences of that integrity. And so here's, I think, one of the lessons for us. If you've grown up in a dysfunctional home, if you have a dysfunctional home right now, you do not have to let that dysfunction determine who you become. You don't. you can make a stand. You can act differently than your brothers or sisters or your parents. You do not have to let that generational flaw pass on to you. You can deal with it. Here's the thing that really stood out to me as I was looking at this passage, and it has to do with the interactions. Because of what Jacob didn't do as a passive parent, how it affected the brothers. And it was all about jealousy. You see, jealousy, when it gets into a family, will always destroy a relationship. Jealousy always destroys relationship. Jealousy is never a good thing in that way. We, in our culture, sometimes confuse envy and jealousy, and we think they're synonyms, but they're not, actually. Envy is that longing for someone else's possessions, or maybe their station in life. So you look at someone, and you look at the vehicle they're driving, and you have envy because it's better than yours, and you go, man, I wish I had that vehicle. Or I wish, you know, I had that person's kind of life. They've accomplished so much. I wish I could live like they live. Or I wish I could go on holidays like they seem to be able to go on holidays, right? It's wanting to have the possessions or the place in life that someone else has. And it often, if you don't stop it quick enough, becomes coveting, right? And coveting then leads to wanting to actually take it and take it away from them. Jealousy is something different. It has the aspect of wanting something else, but there is the aspect of resentment that goes alongside of it. And there's two types of jealousy that I think we need to be aware of. One is that feeling of resentment when someone has gained something or been given something that you feel is yours or you have a right to. This happens oftentimes in the workplace, right? You're working hard, someone else is working hard, there's a promotion up available, and the boss or your supervisor picks that other person to get the promotion. What happens is it's not envy, it's jealousy that occurs. I deserved that promotion. Why didn't I get it? And how often when that happens, if you find yourself in that position, do you have a hard time talking nice about the other person? Just like the brothers, when it tells us in this passage that they were jealous and they had nothing good to say to Joseph. But there's another aspect of jealousy. It's not just if someone gets something that you just think is yours. It's also if you believe you might lose something to someone. And this is where marital jealousy comes into place, right? So a wife will see her husband flirting with another woman. She gets jealous. Why? Because she thinks her husband might leave her for someone else. And if you're still not sure whether it's envy or jealousy in your life, let me give you one other thing. Envy usually involves just two parties, you and the other person. Oh, I really like their vehicle, you and the other person, right? Jealousy always involves three. There's always three parties in jealousy. There's you, the other person, and the third party that caused the problem. So if it's at work, it's you, your coworker, and your supervisor. If it's marital jelly, it's you, your spouse, and whatever that other person is doing, right? There's a three party. In this case, there's Joseph, there's Jacob, and the brothers. Jacob was the one who was highlighting the problem, and the brothers just responded to that problem with jealousy. Wherever there is jealousy, there is never harmony. So if you examine your family, whether you grew up and that's, you know, a couple decades ago, or even now, or you're in the midst of growing up your kids now, is there harmony in your home? Because if the answer is no, there is a good chance that jealousy is involved on some level. Whether you realize it or not. In the Old Testament, jealousy is used in a positive way. It's divine jealousy, where it's talking about God, and he is jealous for his people. And that means that he does not want people following false idols, right? You lose when you move away from God. So that's a proper and a good sense of jealousy. But when you get to the New Testament, there are three occasions where Paul uses the word jealousy. And the first one is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 3. And he says, and he's talking to them about them still being worldly. For since there is jealousy and quarreling among you. So he ties jealousy and quarreling. So if there's jealousy, there is not harmony. There's quarreling. And then he goes on in his second letter to the same church in 2 Corinthians 12:20. He says, I fear that there may be quarreling, jealousy, and an outburst of anger. So not only is there jealousy and quarreling, not harmony, but there seems to be an explosion coming. And then in Galatians chapter 5, when he's writing to the Galatian church, Paul says this in the list of what it looks like to be a sinner. If you want to know what you're sin, if you're a sinner, look up this list. And he says, part of the sinful nature contains discord, jealousy, and fits of rage. They're all in an order. You see, jealousy is tied with discord, tied with not being in harmony. And if you don't deal with it, it ultimately ends up in violence of some sort. Is it any surprise that the brothers would want to kill him because they had were jealous of him and they never had it dealt with? Dad didn't step in because he's passive and they didn't have the fortitude to deal with it on their own. So it shouldn't surprise us that at the end of the day they decide to kill him, they have some mercy and they decide actually to sell him into slavery. So let me ask you again, in your home do you have harmony? Because if there isn't, may I suggest that there might be some jealousy going on. There could be other things. I'm not saying this is it, but it could be. And for some of you who are older, think through now, even though you have your own families, but you know, when you get together for Christmas, how's the environment in the room? Is there harmony? Or is there quarreling? Discord? Is it because there's some undealt jealousy with your siblings? Some favoritism by your parents that's never been called out? Here's the thing. The only thing that I know that fixes jealousy is a Sunday school answer. It's as simple as this. The only fix for jealousy is Jesus. That's the only fix I know. The only fix for jealousy is Jesus. If it takes three parties to get into a jealousy, you need the triangle, right? You, one, another person, and another person. It's going to take you, that person, and Jesus to get out of it. You're going to need the three to get out of it. You see, because jealousy deals with a sense of betrayal, usually. There is a sense of betrayal that goes on when you are jealous. And the only person I know that can help you get through and over betrayal is Jesus. Because ultimately, he's the only one that deals with the sin and the ability for us to have restored relationships. Because he died for you. He's the only one that made it possible for you to be right with God to restore that relationship. He's the only one who can soften your heart enough and the heart of your brother or sister enough that you can come together and restore a relationship that's been torn apart by jealousy. Interesting in this passage, there's only one little mention of God, really, and it's in the dream section. As you read this chapter, you go, man, Joseph has a terrible life. Like, who wants Joseph's life? It starts out okay, right? Like, he's got the fancy coat, he's living the high life, his dad loves him, and then he gets this dream, and at that point, you don't know it's totally from God, it just could be a dream. If you know the rest of the story, you know it comes to fruition. But there's this passage in this piece of this chapter that speaks that God is in control. And no matter what Joseph is going to go through, God is in control. And he is going to fulfill the dreams that he's given Joseph. But it even is bigger than that. If you understand the scope of Genesis, you realize that God had spoken to Abraham and told him that, you know what, your descendants are going to have to live in another country and then I'm going to bring them back. And this is all part of the big picture plan that's going on. And so Joseph, in the midst of this dysfunctional family, has to go through some very tough stuff, and yet God is in control, and we see it behind the scenes. Oftentimes people will read this passage and go, well, isn't there some very serendipitous things that happen in this passage? Think about it. Think about Joseph. He's going to Shechem, and he can't find his brothers, and there's a guy. There is a guy there that says, oh, I just happened to overhear them go. Put yourself in Joseph's place. You're in the bottom of a pit. You've been disrobed, you're probably almost naked, and you're thinking, man, if I only hadn't met that guy, man, life would be different. And as you're reading the passage, you're going, well, that was serendipitous that Joseph met that guy. Now he can find his brothers. And at the end, he's going, well, that was a terrible turn. He met that guy. Now he's been sold as a slave. And yet from the big picture of God, we go, wow, God used his providence in that meeting to point Joseph to his brothers. And even though that's a terrible situation, we know the end of the story because we have that luxury. And God uses that to turn out some amazing things. And he actually ends up saving the entire family because of that guy and that experience. And so why I'm telling you that is, regardless of your family situation, God is a God of second chances. And so whatever you've dealt with, and you might be 65 here today, and you grew up in the worst home imaginable, and you're still dealing with the consequences, the good news is a God of second chances. That means that you can actually change because of what Jesus has done for you. Because God can come in and change us. God is the only one who could take Joseph, who went into slavery, and as we're going to see, into prison, and still remain a man of integrity because he had that relationship with God. God is a God of second chances. And so no matter what your dysfunctional family looks like, God can take you through. I'm not going to say it's going to change tomorrow. I'm not going to even say it's going to change in a couple of years. If you look at Joseph's life, it is years before you find the end of the story and everything turns out right. And sometimes, here's the reality, it doesn't get better. Because to fix a jealous relationship, remember, you need three. So even if it's you and Jesus, that other person still has to be part of the solution. And if their heart is never soft towards God, it probably is not going to happen. But that shouldn't stop you from praying about it. Shouldn't stop you from being the Joseph and standing up and dealing with it. You are the one who God is calling to step into that dysfunction. You are the one who God is calling, just like Joseph, to live through it and remain a man or a woman of integrity like him. Don't blame your parents. You are the one who God is calling to deal with it. God is in control. That is the hope of the Bible. Right? That's the hope. It all turns out. We already know the ending. Revelation tells us. We know the ending. We just have to live it. The other piece of this that I want to just leave with you is, not only is God your ultimate source and your ultimate hope, that and he's the God of second chances and Jesus is the only fix to jealousy, is that you will require outside help. If you are living in a dysfunctional family, you probably don't really know what a healthy family looks like. You probably don't know what it looks like to live in a healthy manner because you've never been in a healthy relationship. You need someone on the outside. And so whether it's serious enough that you need counseling and you need to talk to someone, or whether it's something about just learning new patterns of behavior or learning new ways of coping, whether that's a course in our Southridge University, at least once a year we offer a parenting course. So if you need help parenting, I suggest you sign up and get some help. But here's the other thing. Remember I asked you to look around at someone and judge them and say, hey, I'd like to be them because they seem to have it better. Here's the reality. We have some amazing families in our church. We have really good parents. And if you have a dysfunctional family or grown up in a dysfunctional family, one of my challenges to you is to look for someone and not envy them, not be jealous of them, but actually go to them and say, hey, I've noticed your kids. I really like how they're turning out. How did you do that? What steps did you do? Let me talk to you about it. You need someone else to come into your life. The other piece that I just want to leave with you is that in order to make sure that you're not passive parents and you have a home that is not full of dysfunction, it takes mom and dad. And yes, I know some of you are single parents here, but I'm going to talk to the mom and dad piece right now. You need to be on the same page together. That means you have to have a healthy relationship as parents, as spouses. And so maybe your first step is working on that. And out in the foyer, we have a table for Family Life Weekend. Pam and I have been. Great weekend. It's a lot of work. great weekend, but we have a couple couples who are going, and they actually want to put together a group because you get a cheaper rate. So we're actually trying to save you some money. So go and talk to them. Find out when the weekend is, what it's about, and what the cost is. It's less than trying to go on your own. But it's a great time to get away and work on your marriage so that you can come home and work on your family. So I encourage you to do that. Check out the table after the service. Here it is. No family is immune from problems. We all have them. We do. But for today, here's the call. For some of you, you just need to repent. You need to realize you're the Jacob of the story. You're not the Joseph. You're the Jacob. And you have been handed down things from your parents that haven't been dealt with, and you are turning them and passing them on to your kids, or you've passed them on to your kids because you're older and they've left the house. It is never too late to change. It is never too late to say, this is the day, God, where I am no longer going to act in that way. I need your help, but I'm going to do this. Even if it is to my grandkids, I will no longer be the Jacob. I will no longer be the passive parent or passive grandparent. I will take a stand. For others of you, it is just a call to pray. Call to pray for your family. Because you can't do this on your own. Grandparents, it's never too late. Parents, don't be passive. And kids, here it is for you. You can be the Joseph in your family. You can be the one that breaks the cycle for your parents. But you need to be able to stand to do that. And the only way you're going to do that is walking with Jesus. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, I thank you for today. God, we are a people who live life in this world that is fallen. And so that means that every single one of us has grown up in a family or has a family and it has problems. So God, we thank you for the good news that you are here. You are the God of second chances, so that no matter how often we fail, you can prop us back up and we can start again. God, I pray for those who come from a dysfunctional family and they're realizing it. I pray that you'd give them the courage to be like a Joseph and stand, to have the courage that Jacob never did, and to change. Lord, I pray for those families who are blended here this morning. Man, if that isn't a design to create jealousy, I don't know what it is. But God, I pray for the courage for those parents of a blended family to be able to parent well, to not show favoritism, not to be passive. God, I pray. I pray for those of us who are here this morning who are suffering from jealousy. And we have a resentment towards someone, whether it's a sibling or someone at work or whatever it is, even our spouse. I pray that you help us deal with that, because we will never have harmonious relationships in our life unless you work on our hearts to deal with the jealousy that is in and take it away. Because God, if we don't deal with it, it's only going to get worse. So God, help us as a church to have the courage to do that. Lord, I pray for those who are crying out to you right now. You would meet them where they need to be met, and you would encourage them this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.